Now, when people fail, or when they miss the success after which they aspire, sometimes they're able to explain their failure in one way or another. I mean, think of this. How often have you heard it said by somebody who's failed, well, if only I could have had this or that, then things would have been very different. The lack of something essential has been the real cause of the failure. It may be upbringing or opportunity or environmental circumstances, not being of the right kind. So failure was the result. Something not enjoyed or something not received. These things are often the causes of failure. So when I thought about this, with these thoughts in mind, I began my preparation for this address by trying to make a list of the things which, generally speaking, are regarded as, in some measure anyway, the prerequisites for success. Now, as it turned out, thinking about it, six different items emerged in the list, and I will now proceed to tell you what they were. One, experts say that often most failures and most delinquents come from bad homes, and so I think we could fairly estimate that being brought up in a good home is an important factor in the search for success. A good home. Then number two, it's generally recognised that to be kept in cotton wool is no real training for life. To be born with a silver spoon in the mouth may be all right up to a degree, but if it means a sheltered life, shielded from all adversity, that is now seen to be more of a curse than a blessing. Number three, to be able to lead a clear, simple life, having a sense of responsibility, having some consciousness of the reality of life, is much better than being surrounded by mere superficialities of life, which are empty very often and quite unreal. Hot house plants may be exotic, but they soon fade. Then number four, courage. Courage is quite an important factor. For a person who would succeed, they must be prepared to face setbacks and opposition bravely and with fortitude, and then courageously to strive to overcome them. So courage is important. Then, of course, number five, the fact of opportunity. If you were to ask a good many successful people about how they achieve their success, I think they would confess that one day the opportunity came and they grasped it, and it was the right moment, and as a result they were able to go on to success. And how often have people explained their failure by the fact that they just missed the right opportunity? It came, they didn't grasp it, and it never came again. So opportunity. And then six, and finally, what about appearance? Now, say what you will, the advantage of health and height and handsomeness isn't something to be ignored anyway. Of course, I understand it's not everything. Indeed, these days I cling desperately to belief that it's not everything. But let's be honest, I dare say there are some people here, if they care to admit it, secretly wish they were taller or handsomer. Some of us would settle for more hair. You know, the phrase "coming out on top" doesn't all... I was going to say it doesn't always mean doesn't always describe success. So what I'm saying is, it's not to be undervalued. It does have a place, appearance. So there we are, six causes of success as we look at life. Now, I realise if you made a list, it wouldn't necessarily be exactly like that. It might be different. As we know, we see according to what we are, and that's how it appeared to me. I realise that your list may very well be different. So let me quickly sum up what the list was as it appeared to me. A good family life, realistic training in the science of living, courage to overcome opposition, opportunity for progress, and appearance, a goodly physique. And these gathered together would go a long way, I think, towards making a success of life. Whether you think of that life on the ordinary level of human experience, or whether you think of it on the level of high purpose, they are, in a way, the prerequisites for success. Now, I suspect that you know what I'm coming to. You see, you're one jump ahead of me in this address so far. You know what I'm coming to. I'm going to say that Saul, the son of Kish, had all these advantages. Now, it wasn't contrived. I didn't look through Saul's life and see what advantages he had and then make my list. I was trying to be honest. But as it turned out, Saul, the son of Kish, had all these advantages. Let me just help you to think about it and to recollect why it's true. Number one, he was brought up in a good family. His father was a mighty man of valour, and he was a man of substance, and so Saul had good family connections. Number two, he was not brought up in any superficial hothouse circumstances. His was a simple life when he was at home, living with his parents, having responsibility for his father's business, and having for his father and his family a very real sense of affection. I mean, good proof of that is when you recollect that long and fruitless search for the asses. Remember, eventually, Saul said to his servant, it's in 1 Samuel 9 verse 5, "Come, let us return, lest my father leave caring for the asses and take thought of us." There is in that a revelation of how Saul was related to his family. And then number three, he was not a man who was pampered and precocious. He was not kept in cotton wool, but brought up and trained to work and to have responsibility. And nor did his good family connections give him a swollen head. He had a proper modesty about his position. You remember in the record in 1 Samuel 9 how Saul and his servant sought the help of the seer to try and find the lost asses, and Samuel told things to Saul about himself at that stage for the future, which promised that the very highest things of the kingdom were for him. And his reply to Samuel was modest indeed. He said he was a Benjamite, the smallest of the tribes, and a member of the family which was least in the tribe, and he inferred therefore that he was too low for this high purpose. A very proper modesty was revealed on that occasion. And then number four, again, he was a man of real courage. Whatever we may say about Saul, he was a courageous man. Indeed, in the early days, of course, it was slumbering courage until such time as it was needed, but nevertheless it was real and genuine, because its manifestation came, as you remember, in the matter of Nahash and the insult that he instituted against the nation of Israel, 1 Samuel 11. Saul worked and farmed quietly, and then one day the occasion demanded strength and courage, and he rose up and struck with passion and with force in defense of his nation's life. Yes, indeed, a man of courage. Then opportunity. No man had more noble opportunity, because, as you know, the people clamored for a king, and God granted them a king, but it was God who chose the first earthly king of Israel, and he chose Saul, the son of Kish. So he was chosen by God, and the Spirit of God came mightily upon him, as the record says, and Samuel the prophet and the judge was at his side continually, and the scope for his powers was unlimited. The opportunities and the chances he had were magnificent, and from this high purpose of authority he could lead and bless the people of God and bring them back once more to that great king from whom they had strayed. It was a moment full of promise and possibility, and Saul's capacity matched the needs of the hour, and his capacity matched the call of God. He had the capacity for kingship, and that was his great opportunity and his high purpose. But he had more than that, as you know. Think of the solemn words of Samuel spoken to Saul: God is with thee. Now, it's a short sentence, but my, it's full of importance, isn't it? God is with thee. 1 Samuel 10 verse 7. For a man to have God with him is everything. Think what it means. Walking in the same direction, having the same identity of interests, enjoying a combination of resources. When Enoch walked with God, that's what it meant. Can two walk together except they be agreed? And God was with him. And then the record says a wonderful thing: God gave him another heart, and resultantly he became another man. It's in 1 Samuel 10 verse 6, and it says, "And the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and shall be turned into another man." So it came to pass. The Spirit of God came mightily upon Saul, and he saw visions, and he uttered words of heavenly truth. The divine Spirit took possession of him, and it was so full of wonder that the people cried half fearfully, "What is this that has come unto the son of Kish?" And that day, as you know, there was a proverb born in Israel: "Is Saul also among the prophets?" Now, I know that some commentators say that those words were spoken cynically by those who spake them. But I don't know. You must be judge of that. Perhaps when you come to your discussion, that's something you may like to discuss along. You know that sometimes you can discover what kind of a man you are looking at by discovering who his enemies are. That's one measurement you can put upon somebody. You mark their enemies. And in Saul's case, the Bible tells us that his enemies were the sons of Belial. Now, you know, the sons of Belial is a phrase which means the worst and the worthless. The very worst. Now, when the sons of Belial are against a man, he must be a man to be reckoned with. And then six, and last of all, he was a man of splendid physique. Indeed, it says, "A young man and goodly." That's what the record says about him, "a young man and goodly." It means he was healthy and strong. He was standing head and shoulders above his fellows, and he had clean, windswept limbs. You can picture it if you like. A great, strong, clean, fine, physical man. Saul, the king. Well, now, I've tried in that little review, I tried not to overdraw the picture. But the speakers in this house will know well that how easy it is sometimes to exaggerate in order to emphasize. And if you think I've overdrawn the picture, then you must make allowances. But whichever way it is, it means that Saul was a man with all the causes of success, full of the promise of fulfillment in the high purpose to which he was called. So let's be fair, if we can, looking at him in the first full flush of his kingship, everything is set for a great and glorious realization of the very best in the new experience of Israel with its first king on earth. Now, brethren and sisters of the Oxford Conference, let the Word of God give you a picture of this very same man at the end of his life. First of all, his own words, recorded in 1 Samuel 26:21, his own words, he says, "I have sinned, behold, I have played the fool, and have erred exceedingly." 1 Samuel 26:21, "I have played the fool." Then in 1 Samuel 28, verse 6, chapter we read, "And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams nor by Urim nor by prophets. And 1 Samuel 28, 16, the voice of Samuel at the very end, at Endor. Wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord is departed from thee and is become thine enemy? Now that is the final and abysmal tragedy. A man who began in such a morning of promise at last is seen in the darkness of the night, creeping stealthily to find a muttering witch having commerce with evil spirits in defiance of his own edict. He entered the black market of witchcraft as his last great act of folly. And notice how the word of God describes his failure. At the risk of wearying you, I say it again, playing the fool. The Lord is departed from thee and become thine enemy. The Lord answered him not. God had ceased to operate in his life. No longer did God answer, nor direct, nor control, nor appoint. The final tragedy of Saul. The Lord is become thine enemy. And what makes it so sad is, that sentence so sad, is to recollect how it all began with another sentence. The Lord is with thee. That's how it began. And it ends, the Lord is become thine enemy. Now, quite obviously, we are driven to a question. And the question is, what in God's name brought that about? What happened to Saul to bring him to this desperate and unhappy failure? Well, when anybody is seeking to discover the cause of a disease or the cause of a failure, they have to take note of the symptoms and then try to form a diagnosis as a result of the symptoms. So that's our next step. We must try to look at the symptoms in Saul's life. Think back over Saul's life, and here and there I think you will discover symptoms. At least you'll find pointers to some underlying condition. And I think the first comes very early in his public life. Remember how Saul was anointed king by Samuel and equipped by God to take the kingship, and then the very next day there was to be a kind of popular ratification of the divine appointment. And at the vital moment, Saul could not be found, and when it came to the crunch, Saul was found hiding away. 1 Samuel 10:22. Now just ponder that. I am proposing to you, this is a sign of something. Say what you will, it is a sign of something. And I'm proposing to you, it's a sign of weakness. Now, immediately, I can well understand there are people in this house who want to disagree with that calculation. I understand that. And I'm glad in a way that you do, because as Tom has already said, it's in the interplay of ideas that we discover the truth. And so, I can well understand if you want to disagree with that calculation. You may be saying to yourselves, perhaps, this hiding away was a sign, a very proper sign of modesty and diffidence. And of course, it is true that such hiding away could very well be that. Under certain circumstances, that could very well represent a type of modesty which is highly commendable. Of course. But you see, we are now in the position of being able to look back with hindsight on the life of Saul. And I am suggesting as a consequence that this hiding away was at this stage a sign of weakness. See, when a man has been called by God to kingship, and when he's been anointed and equipped for that high calling, really he ought not to be hiding away and trying to escape the responsibility. Now, that the situation is very human, of course, it is very human. That I readily concede. But being human and being weak are often the same thing. And this really is the point of my argument. Now, it may well be modest, but under certain circumstances, modesty can be wrong. Is that a shocking thing to say? But under certain circumstances, modesty can be wrong. And these were the circumstances, it seems to me, that made it wrong. See, in my own experience over a great many years, I've observed a great many things, and this is one of the things I've observed. In my duty as recording brother for 35 years, I've been able to observe men in all kinds of circumstances, and sometimes there is a need, as you know, for a particular kind of service in the cause of the Ecclesia, in the cause of Christ. And here is a man, shall we say, there is a man, here is a man, called and invited to take it on. But what does he say? He says, no, I am afraid I am too humble to accept this position. It is too exalted for me. I've heard that. I am too humble to take on this duty. Now, that may very well be a proper diffidence and a proper modesty, but sometimes it is not. Because if you examine the issues carefully, and sometimes you'll find that what he really means, what he didn't say, but what he really means is, I do not want to take on the responsibility. I do not want to be involved in this and have the burden of being answerable. He might even mean, I don't want to spare the time. So, ponder this. I may be wrong, of course, but it seems to me that this was the first evidence in the life of Saul of weakness. A weakness in his character. He was hiding away when he should have been standing ready. The next symptom. Now to grasp it, we shall need to read three verses from 1 Samuel 13. Verses 2, 3 and 4. 1 Samuel 13. All right. Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, wherefore 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. And the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all Israel heard say that Saul had smitten a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also had in abomination with the Philistines. And the people were called together after Saul at Gilgal. Interesting, because Saul, for the first time in Israel, set up a standing army, a permanent standing army, 3,000 men, 2,000 under his command, and 1,000 under the command of his son Jonathan. Saul was in Michmash, as we've read, and in Mount Bethel, but Jonathan was far away in Gibeah of Benjamin. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines, and Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And what they heard was this: Saul had done it. Saul had smitten the Philistines. That's what they heard. Now, you may think this is a small thing, but it's a symptom. It's an interesting symptom, because it will recur. We shall come across it again. This strange military pride in the heart of Saul. It shows us that underneath the modesty there's a pride and a jealousy. And it gives us a clue to the kind of way in which things are going to move, and it gives us a clue to the power that would master him at last. Come on a little further to another sign. It's in 1 Samuel 13 verses 8 and 9. And Saul tarried 7 days according to the set time Samuel had appointed, but Samuel came not to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him, from Saul, that is. And Saul said, bring hither a burnt offering to me and peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. Now let's notice the issue carefully. Saul tarried, and then something happened to make the tarrying an impediment. That is to say, and this is important, this is crucial, the people started to move away from Saul. That is, he was losing their admiration and he was losing their support. And that was to him a crucial thing. That was to him more important than the law of God. And in a rush of restless impatience, he intruded into the priestly office and violated the commandment of God. And in effect, he is saying, when all is said and done, it doesn't really matter if Samuel comes or not, because I will offer the sacrifices. Now mark Samuel's judgment on this. Samuel's judgment of this folly, it's in verse 13. Saul, thou hast done foolishly. When the wine press was touching Saul firmly, it brought out his inwardness. It nearly always does. Saul was being made outwardly what he was inwardly. And this is often the case when a man is called to high purpose. High purpose is like a wine press. It was so with Judas. They made him the Lord's treasurer. They gave him the bag. What a wonderful opportunity for him to be revealed as a kind, compassionate, caring man, giving alms to those in need. What a wonderful opportunity. Instead, it revealed him as a thief and an embezzler. It made him to be outwardly what he was inwardly, covetous and avaricious. And so it was with Saul. When he was forced into the corner, as he was then, when he saw his popularity ebbing away, in the corner he was forced. And it revealed him as valuing his reputation as more important than the law of God. And Samuel's judgment, as you would expect, was straight and plain. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee, for now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. Rash and impatient, acting without thinking of the real consequences. Faults, of course, common in all men, perhaps, or in most men, at some time. Let's face it. God knows. Which of us have not acted rashly, perhaps, or impatiently? But you see, these things are doubly dangerous along the line of high purpose. These things are doubly dangerous in the life of a king who is wielding power. Come to another sign of developing weakness in the, or rashness rather, in the heart of Saul. You, of course, you know all these examples well. I understand that. I'm thinking now of 1 Samuel 14. Saul, you'll read there that Saul took an oath on a certain day of battle against the Philistines, saying, cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged of mine enemies. And the people feared the oath, and they took no food. Well, I say they took no food, except one, and that one was Jonathan. He was not present when the oath was sworn, and he was therefore unaware of it. And as he came from the battle, he took some honey from the ground, as you remember, on the end of his stick and his rod, and he ate it. And so the life of Jonathan was imperiled by the rashness of Saul's oath, and could well have resulted in the death of Jonathan if the people had not intervened and interfered and rescued him. It's just one more little symptom, sign of the rashness and impatience of Saul, a man holding power, a man in the high calling of kingship. I want to come next to the story of Saul's disobedience in the matter of the smiting of Amalek, and this is in 1 Samuel 15. Of course, you know this well. I shan't need to dwell on the details with an audience like this, of course. I shan't need to dwell on the details. It's a classic example of incomplete obedience. When Saul was confronted with the defection by Samuel, as you remember, he resorts to lies to cover up his disobedience. And what makes it particularly significant, they were lies of a particularly unpleasant kind. That is to say, they were blaming others for his own folly and then seeking to adorn his mean motives with a claim that he was doing it in order to make provision to serve God with sacrifices. And Saul is revealed, therefore, in a, seems to me, as a double-minded man. Some people would, ruder people than I would, call it barefaced duplicity. But I will content myself with saying he is revealed here as a double-minded man. There's one other piece of evidence which reveals in an awful way the bitterness and hardness of Saul's nature. It occurred during the time that Saul was hunting David from pillar to post. It's in 1 Samuel 22. Terrible story. 1 Samuel 22. Do you remember? It reveals that one day David came to Nob. I suppose that's how you would pronounce it. N-O-B. David came to Nob, a sacerdotal city of Benjamin. Situated on a hill near Jerusalem it was, and on the main road from the north. And the ark was located here, before being moved to Jerusalem. And to this city, therefore, came David when he was running from Saul's persecution. And here was Elimelech, the priest, and David, being in desperate need, asked and received the showbread for sustenance. And also he secured the sword of Goliath. All this, you know, and all there it is. Now, Doeg the Edomite saw this, and he was part of Saul's MI5. He was part of the intelligence service of Saul, and he reported to Saul what had happened at Nob, how that David had been succored with the showbread and how he'd been armed with Goliath's sword. And the point is, for that action, at Saul's express command, 85 priests of God were slain by Doeg, and in addition the men and the women and the children and the babies of this city of Nob were all slain. A massacre, a holocaust in Israel, a terrible and awful act of savagery against innocent people, and the Lord's priests, and done by a man who'd been thwarted in his bitter campaign against somebody who was his best friend, if he only had known it. It's a revelation of what a man is driven to in an extremity of fear and suspicion. Perhaps the most outstanding symptom of all was Saul's bitter hatred of David, a man who was really, as I say, his best friend, and yet Saul persecuted him persistently, ruthlessly, hunting him, as David said, like a partridge on the mountains. Sends him on a mission of danger, hoping he will be killed by the Philistines. Jealousy was one of the master passions which nurtured Saul's hatred of David. The old military pride was offended by the popular song, the Top of the Pops in Israel, which proclaimed Saul's victims in thousands and David's in tens of thousands. And David spared Saul's life twice when he could have rid himself of his persecutor. And Saul knew it. Imagine that. He knew that twice David had spared his life, but it had no effect upon him. His hatred was not softened by that realization, and his bitterness was not sweetened by it one whit. And then the final symptom we've already remarked upon: having secret commerce with the underworld of evil, making an attempt, seeking to find hidden secrets in violation of his own edict, and indeed in violation of God's law, trafficking with that which is devilish through the means of witchcraft. Now, I'm going to detain you for a few minutes, please, on what happened at Endor in the witch's house. If you feel that this is unprofitable, then I shall be pleased to receive your criticism, but I want to talk to you about it, because there are all kinds of explanations of what actually happened. I expect you know that. One of the best received in our community, I find, one of the best received, and one of the most likely you will hear, is that it never really happened. I mean, Saul went there, but nothing of any consequence really happened. That the whole thing was a big fake. Saul did not actually see anything. Everything was described by the witch, and her description was so vague as to be valueless. I said yesterday, I'm fed up with vague generalizations, and some people say that this was a vague generalization as far as the identity is concerned. You remember, she said she saw an old man covered in a mantle, and I've heard people say, well, that's like saying I saw a man in a dark grey suit. I don't accept that. I don't want to go into it now because there isn't time, but the word that is used there for mantle is a very significant word, and it describes precisely what Samuel usually wore, if you looked up the Hebrew word. But we'll leave that for the moment. That's how the argument goes, and many faithful Bible students hold that view of the event, and I do suppose that many faithful Bible students in this house hold that view. Indeed, one of the very best Bible students in our community holds it. Now, I must tell you that I do not hold it myself. I do not accept it. I believe it really happened. God, by his own will and power, reconstituted Samuel, in my opinion, in some way to enable him to enable his lips to pronounce the judgment on Saul that we read from verses 15 to 19. Just as he caused Moses and Elijah to be present on the Mount of Transfiguration. No problem whatever. And the things that fortify me in that opinion are these. First of all, when you were reading the words that the witch spoke to Saul this very day, did you not hear the voice of Samuel? Did you get the impression that it was a hotch-potch invention of a muttering witch, those solemn words that came from her? As I heard it, I could hear the voice of Samuel distinctly. And then, the exact predictions in verse 19 of Saul's doom. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me. The Lord also shall deliver the host of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. If that was an invention, then I would have expected the witch to have tempered it somewhat and to have told him a more pleasant story. For that wasn't calculated to win his help and his protection and his approval. And looking back on it now with hindsight, we know the predictions were absolutely true and were fulfilled precisely. I find it difficult, therefore, to believe that it was just a lucky guess made by an astute charlatan in a witch's guise. The ironic justice of it seems to me to be just right. Saul asked for Samuel, and he got Samuel with the voice of final doom on his lips. And then the other thing, the utter surprise of the witch when what she was pretending to do suddenly happened. Verse 12 says, she cried with a loud voice, and well she may. She was utterly taken aback by the appearance of Samuel. And then, thirdly, I am compelled to accept what the Word of God says. Now, I'm not implying that other people don't. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, for me, I am compelled to accept what the Word of God says. The description was not vague. It was clear enough to convince Saul that it was actually Samuel. It says Saul perceived. Mark that. Saul perceived that it was Samuel. It says Saul, and he stooped with his face to the ground. And then finally, I must accept what the Word of God says from time to time. I mean, verse 11, the woman said, whom shall I bring up unto thee? And he said, bring me up Samuel. Verse 12, and when the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice. Verse 14, and Saul perceived that it was Samuel. Verse 15, and Samuel said to Saul, why hast thou disquieted me? Verse 16, then said Samuel, wherefore then dost thou ask of me? Etc. And verse 20, Saul was sore afraid because of the words of Samuel. Now, with all those categoric statements, if it never happened, and if Samuel was never there, and the whole thing was an absolute fabrication, then I'm compelled to say, I feel in some way I have been grossly deceived. So, That's why I believe it really happened as it says. To me, what happened at Endor is in harmony with the principle which is revealed in the prophecy of Ezekiel. It's in chapter 14, verse 4, when you like to look it up, but it says that God says that if men will worship idols and they seek the prophets of those idols, I, the Lord, will answer that man that cometh according to the multitude of his idols. And that, I think, is what happened at Endor. And God gave Saul his answer through the very way that Saul was seeking an answer. Well, now, that's all I wanted to say. Those are the symptoms, then, of Saul's life. But the cause, of course, lies much deeper. Saul's fundamental tragedy was this. He never really submitted himself to God. He never really submitted himself to the one king. At least that's how it appears to me. Saul was called to high purpose, the purpose of kingship. And the secret of true kingship really is revealed in the New Testament in the words of that Roman centurion, I also am a man under authority, and being under authority I say to this man, go, and he goeth, to this man, come, and he cometh, and to this man, do this, and he doeth it. In other words, the centurion confessed something which a great many other people had missed, and which caused Jesus to marvel, namely, that in order to wield authority, you must first of all submit to authority. That responsibility is first won by submission. That before a man can reign, he must first learn to obey. The philosophy of real kingship is that he who holds the scepter at last is he who has kissed it at first. And Saul's great fault, therefore, was lack of loyalty to God. The words of Samuel give us the clue. To obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. He had not hearkened, and therefore he had not obeyed. He had not in reverent fear submitted himself to the great king. And in a sense he lived without God, and in the end he was without God. He tried to do an impossible thing, and other men have done it since. He tried to please himself without displeasing God. And in the words of Samuel, the Lord is departed from thee because, and it's given to us clearly, the Lord is departed from thee because thou obeyedst not the voice of the Lord. Saul was a warrior king, but there it ended. He was never a shepherd king, like the one who followed him. He was concerned with frontiers and with enemies and with war, but he wasn't concerned really with people as people. He was not a pastoral king. He was a warrior. So let us learn the lesson, brethren and sisters. Having advantages does not mean necessarily certain success. A man may have his father's advice, and he may have his mother's prayers, and he may have the legacy of a true example, and still he may play the fool. That's the lesson. A march without God is a march without success. And the secret of spiritual victory is obedience. There's no doubt of it. And so, my brethren and sisters, let us mark that well as we ponder the life of Saul, the son of Kish.